Hi everyone, I'm Greg Lowe from Down Under in Australia. Fabric Down Under is a production from SQL Down Under. It covers Microsoft Fabric, a trademark of Microsoft Corporation. Opinions and views expressed in the podcast are individual and don't necessarily reflect the opinions and views of SQL Down Under or of Microsoft Corporation. Introducing Show 5 with guest Reed Havens. Welcome. Our guest today is Reed Havens. As the founder of Havens Consulting and a Microsoft MVP, Reed is a seasoned professional with a wealth of experience in technology, organizational management, and business analytics. He teaches business intelligence, reporting, and data visualization, and that's exactly what I wanted to talk to him about today. So welcome, Reed.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I know we've had crossing paths over the years between various circuits between Microsoft and the community. So it's I'm happy to be able to come on as a guest and talk shop a little bit and hang out.
Awesome. That's great. Yeah, I haven't really gotten out of the country too much in recent times after COVID and so on, but hopefully get back to a few more conferences and things in upcoming times. We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
But so how did you ever come to get interested in Power BI? Just a brief... Tell us where that came from.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been in the BI space for about a decade now, starting all the way back in Power Pivot and kind of worked my way up, I think, through the rankings, kind of like a lot of other self-taught MVPs have been. And was pretty much my first job as an analyst was essentially building Power BI reports back for like the finance team and a company that did a lot of contracting with Microsoft. So I very quickly was just thrown into Power Pivot as it was this fresh, shiny new thing as an Excel add-in. And a lot of, like, I think the fun that I had with it was around aesthetics and design. Like, I really enjoyed the extra little elements that went into, you know, making the special buttons or some of the colors and art that kind of went into it. So it wasn't just a generic looking report. And I think the more I leaned into that, the more I kept finding people would come to me for help on beautifying a report. And that's just kind of what I started to specialize in. And, you know, I blogged about it for quite a few years before I went independent and used to work over with Power P3 is what it's called now, but Power Pivot Pro back in the day with Rob, and kind of found that I really enjoyed blogging and doing videos. So that, of course, helps to get yourself some exposure to eventually get an MVP status and all that. So I feel like it was all these little baby steps that just kept leading up to exposing myself more through conferences and meetups and just talking about cool things that I've discovered and reporting. And I really think, you know, doubling down on the aesthetic branch of reporting, which a lot less people do. There's a lot of blogs on DAX and Power Query and modeling, but not nearly as many people talk about the art that goes into the design of reporting. And that just kind of became my niche that I continue to lean on in this day as part of my full stack that I like to do for development.
Yeah, certainly I do recall buying a few books back in those days on some wonderful design ideas and things like that. And it's amazing. But I must admit, I've focused more on the data side. But then I've had to, over the years, come up with things that look appropriate. And it is a completely separate skill set. Yeah. And actually, one of the things that just reminds me is that when we had Power Pivot and Excel, I think one of the things that helped with early adoption was the idea that you could start with someone who already knew their way around Excel, and then you could just teach them a bit more. And I think that actually helped kick off the adoption. But I think it was the licensing where so many people weren't on the latest versions of Office 365 at the time. And so that was a sort of a blocker to getting it out the door. And so pushing out the desktop client was actually a good thing. But I still do wonder how much it managed to get an impetus because of the tie-in with Excel. And because, you know, every organization I go into still has like a shed full of people who just spend their days in Excel.
I'd still even say today, like even back when it was only available as Power Pivot, a very small percentage of people used that. I think if I recall, you also had to have at least an E4? Either is it E3 or E4 license? Like, you had to have an enterprise license too, yeah.
No, I think the Power Pivot add-in was free, but yeah, I think that it you could sort of add it on to all sorts of things. I certainly remember Donald Farmer, obviously an old friend, but yeah. Donald going around and first showing it, and we're all pretty astonished, really, with how that worked. But I think one of the things I did want to ask you about is the positioning in the market now, and because a lot of the people that we've got using it over the years have been coming from Tableau and Qlik and other products, and the biggest limitation that they tend to point out is just the quality of the visuals, you know, has been the issue. And so, yeah, so I'd just love to get your thoughts on where we are and how you think we're sitting competitively.
Yeah, I will say that's probably the last untapped market that we have is, for the most part, every Fortune 500 company has some amount of an E-seat, usually E5 or something like that. Pretty much all of the big companies already have Power BI or a version of it. Maybe not a Fabric capacity, but there's not a lot of market left to sell more seats to big enterprise clients of Power BI because they're just already there, even if they're unused, just because it's part of the package. But the thing that's keeping or preventing those individuals from using it or others are often these like sticking points that are with certain functionalities from the report layer. Power BI from the beginning, like the semantic model since the VertiPack engine came out, has pretty much been the best semantic model engine on the market. And that's not a hard argument for that, but it's a lot harder to argue the report layer in Power BI. It's like we have our scatter plots or bars or lines, but Tableau does make much prettier visuals with a lot more configuration. Granted, there's a bit more learning curve. It's a lot more dials and stuff, but you can do it with enough effort. And it's nearly impossible to do some of that stuff natively in Power BI. You have to go to the custom visual route or script your own, or it's a lot of effort or kind of hacks and workarounds to get that stuff. So thankfully, as of about a year ago, Miguel Myers, who used to be on the Power BI CAT team, as you're probably aware, he was in charge of, he was the visual wizard. When it came to a client needed something to look a certain way, they resourced him to make sure that client got the report looking at it. Yes, he is the guy because he has a lot of expertise in that.
I watched the interview that you did with him recently on the core visuals, and that was very interesting.
Yeah, and it's thankfully they gave him basically a budget and a team and say like, hey, like help to make these core native visuals better. So we're getting a lot of new features. We've just, as of this month, are getting the button slicer that's coming out that has been long overdue. We're getting a KPI card visual that's hyper configurable in its first version. We're lots of roadmaps for updates to the matrix table too. You can pretty much name a feature and they're going to be getting improvements. Conditional formatting is going to get better, but it's all these things that are trying to fill in the gaps that are left from Spotfire, ClickView, Tableau, or any of these other tools that just do the visuals or the hierarchies or anything else better. It's a long roadmap. There's a lot of time and effort that has to go into building it, but we're slowly getting monthly updates from this team that's going to keep adding to this to hopefully reduce that that friction to get hopefully getting people that have been waiting for these new features to come over and move into the Power BI platform, just because there is that one cornerstone feature that 3,000 users kept using that needs to be in Power BI before they can start doing something.
Or they just simply say that you'll always find people that'll say we cannot use it because
X.
Yeah, yeah, and then they'll just point at X. Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
And that'll be the limitation. Do you think you talked about in the larger customers, whether there's not a great untapped market still there, but what about the sort of medium-sized ones? Have you got thoughts there? Because one of the things I find is that there's still a massive gap between where people are with Power BI Pro or PPU and even the existing premium. Have a lot of customers, stuck in that, 100 seats type area where I know locally, I mean, premium is about $8,000 a month or something. And I mean, that's just, not of interest to them. you know, at that level.
Well, thankfully, at least fabric capacity has started only like a couple hundred, I think, a month for the lowest. So it is a more affordable capacity. But I think there's a lot more people who just don't own Microsoft products, period, who are in the SMB market. But just based off of the fact that every enterprise pretty much needs Office. Office comes with Power BI at the E5 level. My understanding from both, I would say, third-party developers and just Microsoft sales reps, it seems like the majority of the E5 or S&P 500 type clients pretty much already have seats. There's not really that many seats left to sell. They just want people to use their products more. But using the product more doesn't always generate more revenue. It's just that the fact that they're happier with the product. The one difference now is fabric capacity. So, you know, Microsoft just wants, they don't really care necessarily as much what reporting tools you're using to a degree. They just, most of the income is going to come from your capacity and compute, right? So it's what your fabric capacity is and how much you're using it. So they just want people with larger fabric SKUs to run the reports and ideally also run it in Power BI. But I do think there is a bigger potential of SMB to have a migration over to the platform versus I think the enterprises are really just going to be people that use the product more as these features become more available.
Yeah, it just strikes me. I do see a lot of these SMB ones that still aren't, you know, where I think they could be if the licensing was better. The other thing is in the larger enterprises, I see the main two areas have always, finance has always been the number one group of people that tend to make use of this. Marketing is the other area that I see a lot. Are they the main two areas, you say?
In terms of people who haven't adopted or that are...
Oh, no, who are actively adopting. Or probably the earlier adopters in the organizations.
Finance, to a degree, does. I would still say that some of the people who have the biggest complaints, certainly about the flexibility of visuals, are often actually the people in finance, though, too. Because they're the ones who, they have the custom P&L tables that has, a percentage row or semi-additive subtotals. Or, all this other extra fancy stuff. They're like, I can do this with a VLOOKUP in Excel, but, doing that in a matrix table in Power BI, well, you're going to have a ton of modeling and a bunch of very complex stack measures.
I suppose that's the thing.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. We end up having to do a lot of modeling work to get around that sort of thing. Yeah.
And I think we've had two things in the last couple of years that have come out, or maybe in the last 12 months, that have helped support that. So visual calcs are going to help a little bit, though that's only adding columns, not custom rows aren't in scope yet, which, again, finance loves to have those custom little subtotal rows. But we have things like InfoRiver or Zebra BI that does these advanced matrix tables, which just let you literally insert a row. So there's at least tools available for clients to do these financial tables that they want to until Microsoft makes the decision someday if they want to do that themselves with some of those. So, but 2 years ago, they weren't really available. You had to do the hacky model. There just really wasn't custom visuals to support it. So you did nasty DAX with a lot of special disconnected tables and custom hierarchies and all this other stuff to get it to look as they want to in Power BI, or they use Analyze in Excel. So thankfully, at least the effort to make a financial statement, or especially a printable one, directly in Power BI Desktop is getting easier and easier, either through integrated tools to the native visuals or custom tools as well.
Do you know, in the early days, the native visuals, they actually published those out into GitHub and let people use them as a starting point. I'm just wondering if that's, I haven't looked, but I just sort of wondered if that's fallen by the wayside as they've become more complex.
They still try to have transparency with every new feature that comes out for, especially now with Miguel doing all these add-ons, is trying to make sure that the custom visuals market has the availability of every new feature or configuration being added to it. I don't really see people editing the base ones anymore. Thankfully, we also have tools like we had Charticulator that kind of is unofficially retired as of last year. Well, Microsoft released a blog last year that says we're not retiring it, but we, as of today, we are no longer updating it. So it's that is a very political way of just saying it's no longer officially supported. But we do at least
have lots of products in that category. Yeah.
We have Denim, though.
They call it abandonware.
Abandonware, yeah. But I would say, like, Daniel Marks Patrick, who's down in New Zealand, he does an amazing job with Denim. So it is effort to build it. Because if you build a custom visual, every single piece has to be built from scratch. Like, it takes time, takes love, and it takes effort, which is worth it for some people. But his tool does make it a lot easier to build a custom visual. It is a custom visual that builds a custom visual. And
that builds custom visuals. Yeah.
And it's great. Yeah. It's open source too.
I think if they hadn't published those initial native ones, I think it would have been much, much harder for people to get started with the custom visuals. What do you think the state of play is with custom visuals at the moment? Because, of course, one of the issues that people complained about early on was the number of places where they would work or not work as expected. And certainly, I think still Power BI report server on premises, for example, last I looked at custom visuals there were some pretty strong limitations or not supported at all.
Report server is its own custom set of issues too. It's just and unfortunately the problem is the gap between features and report versus Power BI Cloud are just going to keep the gap is going to get wider and wider and wider now that we have AI and fabric stuff. But separately from report server, I would say that yes, the first generation of custom visuals that came out of the gate were all free because there wasn't any way to bill for them easily. Like now Microsoft has an option to buy directly from the store, and they have tried to make it easier to create and maintain paid custom visuals and that's why we have Zebras.
Yeah, because that's the other thing. So important is a vibrant marketplace for that sort of thing.
Yeah, because you need a team.
It's one of the things I liked. Yeah, but if I look at things like integration services as a good example, if you look at the controls, there were so many things that people needed, but Microsoft was never going to build them. they were just too niche or things like that. And having a marketplace, where you can go and get it is important. And I think also one of the things I often find when I'm in meetings with product groups, I seem to be the one always putting my hand up saying, like, how do I build my own, or how do I extend that thing, or how do I what? And often they talk like extensibility is in a future version, and that version never comes, and I always think it's early on is when you need that, because that's when the product has the biggest gaps. And if you then have no way of filling the gaps, that's a problem. But they're also hesitant to publish the APIs and all those things at that early stage because they know that they might want to change it themselves. And so then they're left supporting people who've built over the top of it. So, it's a real challenge.
I think we certainly in the last couple of years actually have a couple of companies that are doing well enough financially off of the custom visuals market, especially now that Microsoft gives the easy buy option. So there are... I think there are certainly reliable enterprise visuals. Like if you see a visual that you're installing that was updated back in 2020 and it's free, there is going to be a roll of the dice that it may or may not break. But if the companies that are up there that are going to be like the TrueViz, InfoRiver, like Lumal that does XViz visuals, the Zebra BI type stuff, like they're companies with 30 to 50 employees that specialize in those. So any of those type of enterprise companies that build high quality custom visuals, I continuously recommend to clients is like very reliably safe. Like they're not going to just disappear tomorrow. And like, even if there is a breaking change on their rare instance, they very quickly will make sure that there's an update for that. Or they just give you you can easily get a local file from them and just update it yourself, until maybe the app source version gets a patch or something.
That's right. So, easy enough to do.
Yeah. So I think there is plenty of space for custom visuals in reports to use when the situation arises for it. When there is something far and above beyond what native visuals can do, and there's a need for that. Like a great thing that InfoRiver does is like write back. Like you can do data entry tables and write back to Azure, integrate that a composite model. Native visuals never...
You need to be able to do
And native visuals aren't designed to ever really do that. I doubt Microsoft is ever going to make a write-back visual. That's just not in scope of reporting. But there's a lot of need for it with people who want to do forecast entries, or they want like a table to make edits to a record on a status or something. There are custom visuals that do that for you and do it very well.
Hi, this is Greg coming to you from another time and place. If you have a data-related project that needs to get off to a great start with the right architecture, or if you have an existing project that's off the rails, why not contact us? We help organizations of all sizes, from startups to tier one financials, and we can help you too. Check us out at sqldownunder.com.
That's great. So listen, with the custom visuals, I think the thing is I like the idea of them building an ecosystem more than just building a product or a service. But And so with these upcoming new visuals, in fact, the button slicer, I think, was one that caught my eye, when having a look at that video the other day. And it's really the slicer just hasn't changed much in pretty much since the beginning.
I'm trying to think of a single thing that was added. We got the hierarchy capability about 3 years ago.
Yeah.
But even that, like the first thing is kind of do a regular hierarchy, because you don't want a child node that's blank, but it does not support that. You know, it does support it. The custom visual hierarchy slicer that has had it built in for like 5 years as a checkbox to hide empty nodes, you know, things like that. So
hide empty
nodes. Yeah. And it's those things that are so, it's such a basic need that makes sense given most data sets that those exist out there somewhere. So like they add a feature, but then it's 80% of what you want, you know? So then you have to go the custom visual.
Yeah. Because sometimes you are slicing through big long lists of things and you've got to be able to find them. And so, hierarchy at least makes that more approachable. I have a mixture between customers. I have people that put hierarchies in place in their semantic models, and I've got other people who just don't like them at all. Do you find you use them a lot or not?
It depends on the goal of how they're supposed to, because there's always a path to, like, when you open a report page, you start with a question, and there's a certain number of steps to get to the answer. And sometimes that does require going like 10 levels. Like if a company is large enough with enough categories, subcategories, and sub-subcategories, you can't just go from level 1 to level 10. You have to go down a few steps to get there. And sometimes that is when hierarchies are relevant. Like you filter a page by category and you see a subcategory that's relevant. You drill through to a subcategory page. And that page, maybe there's a slicer that has levels 3 through 5. But there is some type of a natural journey that you can build. And ideally, that does have the fewest clicks and navigation options as possible. But it is required. And, you know, think of a paginated report scenario. There are a lot of people like wide tables with those old school type reports where they want to start from the year to the quarter to the month to the date. And you don't want to just give them a list of dates. They first select a year and then they expand to the quarter. So, you know, there are plenty of, I think, use cases where you want that logical.
You just have to do it. Or you have to have a logical picker that lets you do that sort of thing. Well, in fact, it's one of the things that sort of struck me that the built-in slicers still don't really quite do like I'd like, is more of a way to narrow things down, by typing things. And it's just, still not quite at the level I'd like for that sort of thing.
You can use field parameters too, to would agree. There is, I built this now with a few clients. I saw a YouTube video from that. I wish I had come up with the idea, but Boz over at How to Power BI, who's super ridiculously popular on YouTube, he did one where he used a top N filter on a field parameter. And the field parameter was year, quarter, month, and date. And I think it automatically detects basically what his date range is from a slicer. So he has a date range. If he selects more than a year, the axis on the chart automatically shows years. If he takes the date range start and end, it's more than a quarter, one quarter, but less than a year, it shows quarters, and then it goes down to the month and then to the date. So as he shortens his date range, the scale on the axis automatically drops from year to quarter to month to date. If you're less than a month, less than a quarter, less than a year. And that's a way to auto scale to give you the data that you need to with less clicks. But so there are, I think, some ways to shortcut actions, especially now with parameters and a few other stuff, where you don't have to add them, do 8 clicks. They can, you know, have it automatically shift for them down into the report without clicking on a bunch of other stuff to adjust the scale as they get further into their data.
I was just thinking with a slicer, I'd love to just have an option where I can just type a few characters and have the slicer suddenly limited to just the characters that I've typed, you know, like...
Oh, do you mean the select filter?
Directly in a slicer, yeah.
So that, like what Excel does, you mean in the filter dropdown where you type ASD?
No, not so much that. When I do applications of my own, if ever I used to have dropdown lists and things like that, I would always have... something where when the drop-down list was there, somebody could, you know, click a button and then they could just type a little bit and the list then just limited it to just those entries. And if there was only one entry, then it automatically selected it or, you know, that sort of behavior.
They do have that, I think, kind of in, and it's something that I wish was in Power BI, but they have that in Excel. Like if you click on a pivot table, the drop-down, and you type in something, it does a wildcard filter of a list of items matching. And then there is a button at the top to like filter to selected divisible values or something like that. There is a search box in a slicer in Power BI, which will show you a wildcard search result, but there's no extra button to say filter to selected items. If there's 15 items,
filter to the,
you have
yeah,
to click
yeah, yeah,
15
yeah,
times.
Exactly.
Like I have filed an idea years ago to Microsoft on that and told the MVP channel on this exact thing. Like Excel has this, why is this filter to, you know, visible selected or something, not an option in your search? Everybody wants to do that. So hopefully with Miguel, like I think that is probably one of the things I'm sure he has on his ticket for the new slicer functionality, but that is a annoyingly missing feature. Cause sometimes you might want to search for something, you have 30 items, clicking 30 times is very inefficient.
Well, it depends often too. A lot of those things get loaded out of dimensions, but I mean, as long as even some fairly normal dimensions can have quite a lot of entries, in them. And actually, the worst I've had to deal with that were still valid dimensions, I remember doing work for a company that did maintenance on military aircraft. And, you know, if you start with like an F-16 or something and you break it down to the parts, assembly by assembly, there's a lot of parts in one of those planes. It's... quite surprising. And yes, very ragged hierarchies by the time you start working on that. And so apart from the mods to the slicers coming up, which are the ones that have got you sort of interested?
I will say that some of the roadmapped items that they have for conditional formatting, I think are a big one. Because, today we have... we can do custom titles, but you actually have to write the measure and commit it. You can do custom colors and all that, but again, you have to write a measure for it. So the vision, at least, and hopefully a lot of this will materialize once they start working on it, is having a much better UI that is like the conditional formatting pop-up window will have a lot more configuration. So like if you actually want to do a title, it will kind of let you say, you select a column and say first this plus space plus the formatted value from, you basically can build out your title in the visual, but it's writing the measure in the query and saving it for that visual, but it's not actually saving it into the model. You're not getting it in your fields list. So easier ways for people to use a UI to script their DAX for conditional formatting without actually having to write a dedicated measure for it and cluttering up the model is one big one. And then just a lot more options for everything.
Well, particularly when it's visual specific, and there's always that balance between what should be in the model and what should be in even a report measure for a start, let alone what should just be in a visual for one particular visual. Yeah, indeed. I think the more of that sort of code that ends up in the visuals, though, the more it'll become important to have the upcoming sort of like developer mode for source control and things like that, because you could start to get increasing amounts of code that is just living in those configuration of the visuals.
When we're getting a lot more tools that have just come out, and I've had three of them on my channel in the last 3 months, which like are report practices analyzers. There's the PBI Inspector by Nat, who's one of the Microsoft employees who has a great way to like scan and detect report best practices from the Microsoft documentation. There's the PBI Explorer as well, from the Tabular Tools team. And there's that Power Ops tool as well that is the TrueViz people have built. So three tools that help to document the report layer to a degree. And as we have more visual scope properties being assigned, a lot of these tools I'm sure will be very useful on being able to map out, oh, I have seven visuals in my report that had a dynamic title property applied at the visual level or something, to be able to keep that documented, versioned, and ideally, you know, saved as some type of a project file that's versioned in a Git repository.
Well, I think the main thing I look at is, as soon as, again, it's a thing you take for granted in some things in enterprises, but, you know, I want impact analysis when I'm making changes. Yeah. And things like that, you know, it is still one of the challenges I find with the team is that because they started with a very end user level thing, and how do we get to market really, really quickly, and how do we get the adoption? There was just so much enterprise stuff that was, you know, pushed down the track, you know, and we're slowly backfilling that as time goes on. But yeah, it becomes just super important to even comparisons, you know, here's a report, here's the previous version, what changed, you know, like all that sort of, you know, merging things, detecting changes, shift. It's just not acceptable to just overwrite things and hope for the best.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and then thankfully we are getting those diff compare tools from the report layer, like at least two out of the three things that I mentioned, which is the PBI Explorer and Power Ops. They both have a diff compare tool. Power Ops, I know, is about to release a desktop app at some point, which just will run locally. It lets you pick two project files, and it will just tell you from the report or the dataset layer what has changed. And I think like that's going to be a paramount going forward, is to help audit and provide gatekeeping for some of these published changes as you're going forward.
See, it depends on the organization, but the more enterprise they are, I would have rather seen that as a Visual Studio project type, personally, simply because you're usually versioning those things in conjunction with versions to semantic models, mm-hmm. to underlying data warehouse databases, to all sorts of things that could all be part of the same solution. And having them all splayed all over the place is not a great thing, really.
I agree. Yeah, it depends on the scale of the company.
It's a different audience.
Yeah, exactly. Like there's the difference between SMB and enterprise with some of that stuff, and whether or not it's automated as an Azure DevOps plugin for scanning for changes and stuff, versus if you have one developer who does everything, some desktop tool will be fine.
That's not a problem.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, that one developer who does everything can work with a single BIM file too.
Well, true, yeah. But even that person hopefully has a bit of gatekeeping where, If they publish something, you want to hopefully some deployment pipelines or something to help make sure that there's testing before they publish to production.
Yeah, actually, that integration's become a lot better as time's gone on. I was in the early meetings where they were talking about the deployment stuff, and I just wanted them to make it all Azure DevOps plugins and, you know, connect to that, because it was already doing all the stuff that was needed, but they seemed determined to go off and do their own thing at the time. But fortunately, they are backfilling all of that again, you know, at the moment. What about testing? Have you got any thoughts on UI testing for any of this stuff? Or do you see people doing it at all? Or
in terms of like what's being changed in the traditional core visuals team, or what do you mean by testing?
No, I'm just thinking people building Power BI reports and things, whether they're actually doing any sort of what sort of testing, you know, like any automated testing. I mean, you know, like if you're as part of a deployment pipeline, you know, it's like how do I know this report still works?
There is some testing that can be done automatically, like the PBI inspector that Nat has built does have, it can run the best practices analyzer on anything deployed and tell you if at any point something doesn't meet that criteria. But unfortunately, that doesn't necessarily tell you, like, let's just assume you added a new page and you forgot to sync the slicer for product category with the other five pages. There's nothing wrong with that, but if the requirement that was written does say that they should all connect, that's something that really can only be tested from an actual tester opening it up clicking and then writing down notes.
Yeah, that's what I'm sort of wondering. Like, I mean, for example, if you're pushing out semantic model changes, it'd be good to have visibility on what reports are affected for a start in a much better way. But it's also, I think, important to know, did I break any of them? You know, I mean, yeah. That's the other thing you're looking to do. And with typical web stuff, I mean, people normally go in with, I don't know, Selenium or there's another one that the Microsoft guys use quite a bit at the moment. I can't think of the name off the top of my head. But some of those sort of tools that sort of automate the UI testing of something in various ways. And yeah, I just wonder if any of that exists. It's a bit like in reporting services. I've always been a fan of not having much logic in the report, you know. So I rather the report just render things rather than work things out. And so, you know, I used to like calling a proc, for example, that returned the report data, because then I can just wrap a test around the proc on it, and it's easy to know that I didn't break that, and any report based on that is still going to work. But yeah, I do wonder if I said, like, I made semantic model changes and I pushed them out. You know, I have one client I was doing work with the other day, and he's a bit sort of, we would say, gung-ho, but I mean, he would just push it out and see what breaks, and you know, then he knows he's around to fix it in a hurry. But I mean, that's not a good plan.
Yeah, it's, I think we're getting better at providing automation for some of this design, but for any of these automations to work properly, you also have to make sure that all the requirements are properly written down, and that doesn't always exist. And even with the clients who do write that down, sometimes it's not until they actually start poking around on something. Like, let's just assume that slicers don't cross filter each other naturally in Power BI. That's something that Power Pivot had turned on, but it's just not done by Power BI. And a lot of reports that I deploy, at some point somebody clicks like a year and then they click a customer and it blanks out the page because there's just no customer. That customer did not have sales that year. And like, oh, this is broken. Well, no, it is functioning as designed, but if you would like these to cross, yes. But if you'd like these to cross filter, I can put, you know, a special measure on the slicer to do something. You know, so a lot of those issues or bugs aren't actually bugs, as they're just the default behavior, and then you have to fix it after somebody explores it. And that's still, like, I don't think a tool is ever really going to actually be able to identify those aha moments, because you have to get in the brain of a person who's actually using the report. Yes, some of that can be automated in terms of you could probably figure out a way to have the AI something automatically know if 5 out of 6 slicers in a report are all synced and a new page doesn't have that, that's a yellow flag. Like, likely this should probably be synced because all the others are. So, you know, soft warnings like that and recommendations, but there's still going to be a lot of those little UI type things. Somebody doesn't want the pin icon and the visual headers or something. All those little extra small details that could eventually become a best practice, but there'll always be enough exceptions that some amount of manual review, I think, from users will need to be done as part of that, like, review process to make sure nothing's quote unquote broken.
I see more and more discussion about where people pretty much. Many no longer using dashboards.
they've been dead for a while.
What's your thought on where that story is?
I mean, kind of like slicers, they really haven't got a lot of love in the last few years. There's a couple of cool ideas that became better products elsewhere. So we had the tile alerts. That is what became goals, which is what became in some capacity data activator that we have now and all that other stuff. So the first place to get alerts, you could only get that from tiles and
from a dashboard. Yeah.
So they
configured on
tile. There was a little bit of a resurgence where, oh, dashboards are useful again, but dashboards are 95% the same thing that they've been since Power BI was released. Like, they really haven't changed that much. There's a series of Windows 8 style, like Metro tiles, and before we had composite models, they were great because you could combine cards and elements from multiple models into a single dashboard for your C-suite executive, which kind of was the point of that. It was a quick overview. But all of the things that it mostly serviced was either added to reports or to modeling or to another feature. So I haven't built a dashboard myself probably in 2 years, like I think plus for a client.
Yeah, that's what I yeah. wondered. Yeah, so the I've seen them pretty much disappearing, and yeah, that's the thing I sort of wondered about, because just opening a report straight to that seems to be the default behavior now, because you can do so much.
And the streaming data sets used to be a dashboard only thing, but we have the auto page refresh built into Power BI and a lot of other stuff that can do most of what the dashboard could. So it was the first gen of a lot of really cool concepts, I think, that were collected there. But eventually they added more robust versions of these other concepts in other places. So they're,
You mentioned streaming data sets. Did you make use of those? I think I noticed a little while ago that they were making them disappear.
For presentations, they were really cool. Like, you know, when you're doing a talk and you have somebody scan a QR code, fill out a survey, and then the report updates in real time on a dashboard.
Appears right behind
you. Yeah, that was slick. That was great for presentations. I loved that. But any client that actually needed streaming data usually wasn't used in Power BI. There are other platforms that are designed for instantaneous IoT type streams and stuff like that, and usually alerts.
Yeah, although the visualization of it was pretty nice, actually. Yeah. In fact, the one that caught my eye, there was a company out of Sydney that was building little Raspberry Pis that they were sticking into white goods stores, you know, so like into every microwave or every fridge or everything that was sort of on a showroom floor. And literally, as you were opening doors and things, it was just sending stuff up. And then like nationally or whatever, they could just sit and look at who's looking at what, you know, and so on. It was in a streaming data set. And I thought that's pretty cool. You know, actually, I like the look of that. There was also one that was breathing machines where people were dealing with asthmatic problems and air pollution problems and things like that. And again, they were just centralizing all of that. So and literally they could just sit and watch areas of the country and so on. It's just completely fascinating. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, so there were things there for streaming, and just be interested to see how that ends up longer term. And because having a data set that responds automatically is pretty nice in some way.
Yeah, and I think with the data activator and
more for demos and things.
Well, data activator in OneRiver, I think, is where all that streaming stuff is headed for the most part.
Hmm. Yeah, I did a show recently where you had Will Thompson on data activator and covered off a lot of stuff, so people can go and have a look at that. And on that topic, so Reid, where will people see you upcoming, or what's happening?
Yeah, I have a few things coming up. So we do have the SQL Bits that I'm going to be presenting at. Like, March is the busy month for a lot of us. So
wish I could be at that one. Yeah, that's it's always looks like one of my favorite conferences in the world.
That's super, super fun conference. Alex, that, you know, is partially organized by Alex Whittles and a few other outstanding MVPs like Ben Weissman. And,
yeah. Some saving
exactly, yeah. But I'll be at that one. Likely going to be at the Fabric conference in Vegas, though I'm still waiting on final approval for a request from somebody at Microsoft to present there. So hopefully I will be at that one.
I think they've pretty much narrowed down the Microsoft presenters, but not so much the community ones.
A lot of it know is they're finalizing budgets for like people they can bring in. So like that's pretty much what I've been invited, but it's to see if there's actually a budget approval for it is essentially the cue on that. But hopefully I'll be at that one as well. And then I will say for people who are interested, I'm the end of January, I'm co-hosting a finance training modeling reporting webinar with Steve Campbell that I'm doing online. And if people are interested, check out the link that's in this podcast description. But I'll be doing it's one day of content done over 2 days to two half days of training that we're doing. That's going to try to hit on how to model for financial like reports, like P&L, FP&A, finance type statements, and also how to do visuals natively and also using some custom visuals. So those are kind of three big things that I'll mention. So two conference links if you're curious about those, but then also check out if you're at all interested in leveling up your finance modeling and reporting skills. We'll be doing a webinar you can sign up for as well.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, in fact, a lot of customers I deal with tend to be financials.
So it's trying to do a mixture of breadth and depth.
Be able to point them at that. Hmm. Awesome. Well, that pretty much brings us to time. So look, thank you so very much for being involved today,
Rick. Absolutely. Yeah, I appreciate you coming on. It's been a blast to talk with you.